The retirement and IRA show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer member FINRA SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Saulnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A edition today. We're going to do our best to answer some of your submitted questions. I know the last several weeks we've kicked things off each time with a Social Security question. I think we're getting a bit caught up on that, but I'm guessing that Jim might have a Social Security question for us. But today's going to be a surprise for me, as it normally is, because he just digs through the pile and finds a series of questions that we... go through. Sometimes I have to veto one that I might have to look up some details on. But yeah, Jim, are you with us?
I'm here.
Perfect.
All right. Yeah, we do have a Social Security question. We're going to jump to the top of the list only because it's kind of a, I guess you could say, a sad one that you might be able to help her with. We shall see. Before we jump into that, you and I didn't have a chance to talk beforehand, but if the recording goes long and you need to leave because we're not starting this till, gosh, what time is it?
4:23.
We have 4:23 on a Tuesday.
We can always pause it.
So. I was going to say pause it and we'll pick up recording the rest of the questions tomorrow so we can easily do that. All right. Well, before we begin, we do have a North Carolinian, Linian, however you would pronounce that, who heard the show where I mentioned that I may move to Asheville. Actually, several people have. And one person emailed me some information on some water issues in North Carolina that he felt might sway my decision on whether or not I move there. But
water issues? Like what?
Oh, he... his email is downstairs. I don't have it
like
up here.
Like the water's poisonous or?
Yeah, some issues with the water, some stuff in the water. Hmm. And from what I can see, this stuff, I forget what the initials of it was. It was in his email. Doesn't seem to be in the Asheville, North Carolina area, but other parts of North Carolina. It was all over Kentucky. I found this website that had a map of where all this stuff is. And the poor state of Kentucky was knee-deep in it. But no one had ever mentioned that to me before. But it looks like the Asheville area of North Carolina was clear. For those who are wondering why we're talking about Asheville, for several years now I've been sharing with listeners my quest to decide what I'm going to do when I myself retire. Chris and I are getting up there in years. We're in
What? You got a lot more years than I have.
I don't have a quote unquote a lot. I think you can count on I could lose a couple of fingers on my hand and still count our age difference. So it's not that big. But we are contemplating our own retirement. Chris will never leave Colorado or the arid West because he just can't stand anything but hot, dry weather. Me, on the other hand, am contemplating...
Well, I like it when it's cold and dry, too.
True, you just like it dry. I, on the other hand, am contemplating perhaps relocating. And Asheville, North Carolina is one of the places. The entire state of Kentucky, which, again, Chris has thrown under the bus. He doesn't like that idea, is another area. Cheyenne, Wyoming, another area that Chris doesn't really like. But Asheville, you didn't have anything negative to say about them.
I've not been there, but I've heard much more positive things about that area than the other two you mentioned.
Well, I do want to point out someone sent a rather lengthy email, and I won't read it all. But I remember we were trying to figure out how they came up with the name Tar Heels.
Yeah, vaguely.
Okay. Well, he sent us a opinion, his opinion. Now, he's a native North Carolinian, Olinian, and this is the way they were taught, that it came from Robert E. Lee, a quotation of him, from the Civil War. And he referenced it from a book called Grandfather Tales of North Carolina History from 1901. So you know the guy who wrote that, he had to be around during the Civil War if he wrote it in 1901. But he wrote, during the late unhappy war between the states, North Carolina was sometimes called the Tar Heel State because it was the state where tar was made. And because in battles, the soldiers of North Carolina really stuck to their bloody work as if they had tar on their heels. And General Lee is said to have remarked, God bless the Tar Heel Boys. And that's how the name for North Carolina came about.
Interesting.
I mean, it's as good as any other
explanation.
Explanation. Yeah. But
well,
yeah.
It's the only explanation I've ever heard, so it's the best one I've heard so far.
If anybody has a better explanation than that, it makes sense that Lee would say, I mean, they gave Stonewall Jackson his nickname because he stood like a stone wall. So why wouldn't a bunch of people, men from North Carolina who refused to give ground, why not call them the Tar Heels? Because they're from a state where they make tar, and tar's sticky, and you'd kind of stick there. So I thought that was a pretty good thing. And then he got into a little bit, and it was very funny email. It was very, very. It made me giggle and laugh a few times, but I won't read the whole thing. How he started talking about some of the colleges and the names that each college took and the mascots, and it was pretty good. But he did say, we would most likely call the Great Smoky Mountains, where Asheville is located, I would probably consider them the Great Smoky Rolling Hills. That compared to Colorado Mountains, the Smokies are just not really going to be much.
They're still pretty.
They are pretty. I've been looking at Google satellite views. And I did street views, but I did some satellite views. There's a hell of a lot of trees out there.
Yeah. That's what makes me so claustrophobic when I go places
like
that.
I mean, the whole thing is trees everywhere. So I even in Asheville, I mean, the whole, you have to really zoom in to see that there's a house through the trees. So I do take that into consideration because in my 70s and 80s, if this is going to be my retirement location, I am not going to be in a position to clean leaves. But hopefully my house, if I was to move, wouldn't have as many trees because they would all be knocked down for a beautiful garden. Okay, let's get to a Social Security question. This came in recently. It's kind of a long one. Let me read through it. I'm not sure if we're going to be able to help this woman. My gut tells me no, that the timing is just not right. But I thought we would read this. This is from a Massachusetts person. Okay. She said it's, she begins, this is a really complicated question. It's not that complicated, but there are a few moving parts here as far as divorce spouse benefits go. And I think there might be a way we can help her or the laws help her. And I think you'll pick up on this. A bit of good news. I'm not sure. Okay. This may be a little bit too long to read, but I'll try to be brief. I began a relationship at age 16 with a man who was 26. As much as my mother disapproved of this relationship, and I should say she is in her 60s now. I believe she is 61. She didn't say that, but if you do the math, Chris, it looks like she's about 61. Mm-hmm. Because the man is 71, and there's a 10-year age difference, so I came up with 61. Okay, so she was 16, he was 26. Mother did not approve the relationship, but you know 16-year-olds, they know better than mom. And she kept seeing a 26-year-old man. And in 1980, they decided to marry. And she had her first child at age 20. She got in to say, I won't give the reasons, but the marriage, needless to say, Chris, ran into some trouble. And in less than 1 year, they divorced, or separated. And a year later, August of 1982, they divorced. So they got just about 2 years in with that marriage, okay?
Mm-hmm.
I am ashamed to say I ended up remarrying the very same man again 6 years later in January of 1988. And had a second child with him in 1989 and divorced him in 1997. I believe it was love, but there was also, and she got into some of the problems, which I don't want to read on the radio. And because of those problems, she did divorce him the second time, 9 years later. Almost 9 years later, January of 88, she doesn't say where in 97, Chris, what month she divorced him. Mm-hmm. Just that she married him in January of 88, divorced him in 1997. I was not allowed to work when I was married to him, so I do not have any income. He controlled nearly everything. He has fought about paying me child support, and also warned me not to ask for any alimony because he won't give me a dime. Now, the one thing I can say, listener, the state of Massachusetts, I know this because I used to live there, they have some very strict rules. I could care less if he doesn't want to give you a dime. There are rules, and if you're not pursuing them for one reason or another, I'm not going to pry. But just because someone says don't file for alimony, I'm not going to give you anything, doesn't mean all the laws that Massachusetts has on the books just goes away.
Right.
So do keep that in mind, and I'll leave that up to you. This happened years ago. You divorced him in 97. It's already 2020, so a very long time ago, 23 years ago, but it is what it is. So she goes on to say, Chris, to this day, I am now disabled since 1993 and receive SSI benefits. I live on my $704 a month in benefits. Is there anything I can do to get help from my ex-husband's Social Security benefits as he is now 71 and collecting them? Thank you. I hope this wasn't too much info. And I skipped over a lot of the things she wrote about her marriage. I didn't think they were germane to the topic. Mm-hmm.
Anywhere does it say she has contacted Social Security and asked them?
No, she hasn't. The thing that I'm picking up on is, can we add the two marriages together to hit 10 years?
My understanding is yes. So they're, I will update everyone if I reread after the show. I'm going to reread it because I haven't looked at this for a couple of years. But my understanding, if my memory hasn't failed me, is that if you remarry the same person, those time periods do add together to get you to the 10-year mark. And what's magical about that 10-year mark is once you have been married for 10 years and then subsequently divorced, you as a spouse have all the rights to claim benefits as if you were still married, which means she is has the potential to receive a spousal benefit while he is alive and ultimately a survivor benefit when he passes away, regardless of whether or not he's remarried. She, as long as she has not remarried, This would be true if she's remarried already. That changes the rules a little bit. If she remarried prior to age 60, she does give up claim to the survivor benefit if she had been claiming it. It sounds like from the story, she has not remarried. Her only remarriage was to the same person in the scenario that was described by Jim. So I think she has actually a good case and likely would get benefits. She would need to contact the Social Security Administration. She will want some documentation. Ideally, she'd have the marriage certificates that she has got, some kind of documentation about the length of her marriages to this person. Ideally, also, she would have that person's Social Security number. Makes it a little bit easier for them to look up his record. They will not tell her about him and his claiming or his benefit that he's receiving, but they will tell her what her potential benefits are, because she is entitled to receive them if she does, in fact, have documentation somehow that shows she was married at least 10 years to this person. And from my math, walking through the story, it sounds like she does. The separation doesn't matter. So those of you who picked on the fact that she said they were separated the first time in less than a year, but it was 2 years from the first marriage, the first marriage when they officially got divorced. The whole 2 years counts. You don't have to be living together for this yearly, you know, time clock to be ticking on this 10 years that you've got to get to in order to have these types of benefits. But I think we do have some good news for her, and it would really all start with her gathering together some basic documents and making an appointment at her local Social Security Administration office, and they can let her know what benefits she might be entitled to get. Now, if she doesn't still have the marriage licenses and that sort of thing, those are generally still available in the county in which that license was issued when you go to the county records. So she wouldn't necessarily have to still have possession of this documentation. And it is possible that Social Security might have some of this information already, but I would probably arm yourself with all these documents before you go in, because they'll likely want to have copies of them, and they'll make copies of them while you're in there. Talking to the representative. I would love to hear what they say. If you have luck, you know, if it's good news or bad news, and I would especially like to hear if it's bad news, because I would like their explanation as to why you don't qualify, because all indications are that you do, and make sure they give you the reason why you don't. And if you want to share that back with us, I would be happy to look into it to make sure you are being denied appropriately. Because sometimes the first answer you get at the Social Security office is not the right answer, and you have to push it. And a lot of people, unfortunately, get misguided information, and they lose out on benefits that they could otherwise claim because their first visit or first conversation with Social Security was with someone who hadn't perfectly interpreted the rules. So if you get denied, please let me know, and it might be legitimate. They might fill you in on some extra information, or maybe there's an element here that we're not being apprised of in your description, but don't give up. If they say no, don't give up without reaching back out to us, and I'd be happy to look into it a little bit more with the detail they provide to you about what the ruling or the reason behind the denial. They have to give you a reason. They can't just say no. They'd have to give you a reason, and if you bring that to me, I'll make sure that it's legitimate.
Okay, perfect. Next question. This one is kind of a clarification. Well, maybe not a clarification, more of an overt statement, which is what he's asking for. So he sent this in reference to the latest, or might have been two episodes ago, I'm not sure, of our show. And he says, on episode 2030, I wish you would have stated overtly that for those who turn 70 and a half in the 2019 club, that we can return those 2019 delayed RMDs back to our IRAs. I thought I mentioned you could. I didn't go back and listen to that show. That was that whole EDU show that we did on, 2020-51,
IRS release of right. Kind of the
clarifying
remarks.
Their original clarification.
Yeah, exactly.
So I'm not going to rehash that whole issue, folks. I think I did mention it, and I believe I emailed this man and said, you know, I could have sworn I mentioned it, but I will make mention. Because he continues, you mentioned this peripherally a month ago. Did I nail that?
Close, yep. All right. Close enough.
You mentioned this, that word, a month ago when discussing a different situation. And recently a friend forwarded me from Team Kitsis a newsletter from June 21st where he just writes, all unwanted 2020 RMDs can be returned. But as an amateur like myself, it would have been nice if either of you guys would have added a few more words, such as including those unwanted 2019 RMDs taken in 2020.
And that part's the key, the taken in 2020 part.
Correct, and I was going to get to that. Yeah. When I Googled Form 2020-51, it's not really a form. It was in a, what do they call it, an opinion or something?
I thought I printed it out, but I might have disposed of it.
When I Googled 2020-51, the IRS document, I found it overtly states that delayed RMDs can, delayed 2019 required minimum distributions can be returned. Correct. It is probably worth a 30-second comment on a future podcast to clear this air. Thank you, George from Georgia.
We just did.
What I'm going to overtly, thought I made this clear on the EDU, but apparently I didn't. What you're allowed to do, remember, folks, if you were required to take an RMD in 2019, now that's before the SECURE Act. So that means 2019 was the year you turned 70 and a half. So it's a very narrow subset of people. It's not everyone who had to take an RMD in 2019. Only those who turned 70 and a half in 2019. Not those who turned 70. Not those who were already 71, 72, 73. You had to have turned 70 and a half in 2019, not 71. So you had to be born essentially July 1st or later. And if you turned 70 and a half in 2019, you could have delayed your 2019 required minimum distribution until April 1st of 2020. Then, lo and behold, in January of 2020, they changed the RMD age from 70 and a half to 72, but they did not grandfather those people who were delaying their RMDs, Chris. They said, nope, you were 70 and a half under the old rules. You still got to take it in 2020. Then, in March of 2020, the government passes the CARES Act and says no 2020 RMDs are needed to be taken. And the IRS comes out and says, well, we are going to include, for a very narrow group of people, 2019 RMDs that were delayed until 2020. And this surprised you and I, Chris, because it's a 2019 RMD, not a 2021. And the law exempted RMDs only in 2020, the CARES Act. But the IRS said, nope, we're going to consider the 2019 RMDs that were delayed. That is essentially anyone who turned 70 and a half in 2019 and delayed it. So I am overtly saying you are allowed to put that RMD back into your IRA as well by August 31st of this year. I could have sworn I said that on the original EDU show, but perhaps I was wrong.
Let me clarify one other thing just for accuracy before we bail on this question.
Did I screw up something?
I don't know. Not many people pick up on it, but you said you would have had to been born after July. You would have had to been before July. So in 1949?
Yeah, after
these are the
June
people.
30th.
Nope, you had to be between January 1st and June 30th
Right. I got it pass backwards.
Yes, so I just want to point that
out. Well, thank you, Noah, for clearing the air. It's the other way around.
We try to be as accurate as possible, so...
No, I appreciate that. I misspoke. That was for
I knew
sure.
what you meant, but you did say it bass backwards.
I did say it bass backwards. Yep. Okay, with that in mind...
Just proof, by the way, that I do listen to Jim while he's answering these questions.
Every once in a while, you do listen. Yes. Okay, we got another question from a listener with regards to this. I'm going to answer it now because the deadline of August 31st is approaching. It begins, dear Jim and Chris. I have been listening to the wonderful podcast lately, which has been so helpful. Mm-hmm. She is referencing podcast episode 2030, the EDU show on 2020-51. Hmm. This person is a fellow advisor, or advisor-et, I guess you could say. It is a female. We're going to call her George, or Georgette, right?
Either one works.
But we won't use her real name, as always. We protect her anonymity. Okay, she says, I'm working with an IRA client or customer who wanted to take advantage of rolling back his monthly RMD distributions, including the taxes that he had withheld. I completed the rollover and withdrew the taxes that were withheld from a savings account and put that back into the IRA too. Mm-hmm. Since this is new to everyone right now, I'm wondering if you could help by answering some questions that I and my client have about this rollover. Okay. Ready, Chris? I think you can nail these three questions. Question one, can we really roll over the back taxes paid? If not, well, we already did.
Yes, you can.
Yeah. Do you want to expand on that or just yes? Money's fungible. Yeah, we always say that.
The fact that they withheld, which is clearly what happened here, otherwise they would have had the money out there. They wouldn't have to tap this other source. They had some withheld and sent in for taxes. It's fine to replace those dollars. They don't keep track of them by serial number, thus the fungibility of money. And so it's totally fine to use a different source to put back the entire amount. And then the amount that ended up getting sent into to the government in tax withholding, that'll get all reconciled when you file your taxes for this year.
Okay. How will my client get the taxes back from the government?
Oh, I already answered that one. When you do your taxes. Mm-hmm. When you do your taxes, it's going to just be recorded on that line where it says, put in here all the money you've had sent in already. How much is that? It'll be included in that, and they'll compare it to how much tax you actually owe for the year, and if you've withheld and sent in more than you owe, you'll get it back, and if you still owe more, you got to send it in. If you nailed it right on the head, then it's a wash, but that's when it's going to get reconciled. So if they are owed money back, that might be a reason to file next year earlier than later in order to get that return, that tax refund back, if that is in fact the case.
Okay. Question three. How will my client's 1099 look? Will it show the total distributions he took in 2020, or is it just going to show the taxes he paid?
That's a good question.
It's going to show it all. They don't know that he put it back.
That's true. That's true. He's going to have to report that he put it back.
Mm-hmm. On the 1040. Yep. You adjust for it on the 1040.
Yep. That is a good question. But, they're not going to know that you and record. They don't have reverse the 1099. They don't know that was the reason for this money being returned back into the account. So, you'll have to keep good records on this in case you ever get looked at.
The form 5498 mm-hmm. is how the IRS is going to mm-hmm. check on all this, folks. So what happens, and what this listener is asking, the client is her client is going to receive a 1099 for distribution from his IRA. Even if he put the money, Chris, back into the same IRA.
Right. Still going to get it.
Right. The custodian isn't going to track that. The custodian is going to show the gross distribution. It's not going to say, oh, this money was put back, so let's net out the money that was back and just show the taxes that were withheld. It's not going to work that
way. There's a lot of reasons for these cash inflows and outflows from these accounts, and the custodians aren't in a position to guess what the reasoning is behind this, so that's why. You might think, well, it's obvious what they're doing. It isn't obvious. There's a lot of things that could be happening here, and the custodian steps out of the way of this. It's up to you to track all this and document all this.
Right, and in general, we did talk about how 2020-51 made it clear that if you were in violation of the one rollover per year rule, they were going to call this a repayment, and the money must go back to the same IRA you took the money from. However, in general, that rule doesn't apply, and the IRS doesn't care what account receives rolled over money. Doesn't have to go back to the same IRA. So because of that, Chris, custodians don't know if the money you're putting back came from another IRA, this distribution. So they don't track it, and they don't have to. What the IRS says is every year, do 5498 in May and report to us money going back in. So what's going to happen is your client's going to get a 1099, and on the 1040, I forget where now on the form, we don't have Bob on the show, and the form changed a couple of years ago, and I'm not too familiar with the new form like I was the old form, but you're going to show the gross amount of the distribution from the 1099, and then you're going to put the taxable amount on there, and if there's a difference, we used to write rollover in the margins. And what the IRS is going to look for, Chris, in May is a 5498 showing the receipt of that money. Form 5498 is when custodians will report money that was received, and they're going to match up and make sure, if you're telling them you put that money back into an IRA, that there's going to be a corresponding 5498 in May that shows that. And that's how they're going to proof it. So they trust you until they get the 5498. And then if it's not on there, then you're going to get a nasty gram from them.
Yeah.
Okay.
Those good questions, though.
Yeah, so far, so good.
Good at all. Glad it all worked out, because it sounds like they did it anyway.
Yeah, that's just what I thought. She asked a question and said, we already did it. Yeah. So, yes, you can do that. Mm-hmm. So, all right, let's do one more question, then we'll pause, go home, and relax. I need
be four questions.
But we didn't spend an hour. So we just
depends on how long we rant and rave on this next one.
Well, this one will be fairly quick.
Okay.
Okay. All right. So this one says, "Hi guys, I almost said his real name because he put it, but we are going to call him George." He says, "Hi guys, I am George in New York. Mm-hmm. I discovered your podcast a few months ago, and I have been enjoying it very much. Thank you so much for taking my question. I have 30 plus years in a very large telecom company. I have a 401k and an IRA and a pension that I will be due upon my retirement. My pension has a lump sum option. Now, due to the unprecedented low interest rates, my lump sum value has jumped significantly over the last 9 months, and that makes sense, Chris. The lower the interest rates, the higher the lump sum pension payout will be. So he said, over the last 9 months, my lump sum pension payout has jumped significantly to the upper six-figure range. I would possibly like to retire in a few years. But I am wary that if interest rates rise again, my lump sum payout may potentially drop, and the gains I recently made be lost." You really haven't made gains yet. But I see what he's saying with this, that his lump sum payment is going to be based on current interest rates when he retires in 3 years. And if they're higher, the payments are going to be, the lump sum payment, rather, is going to be lower than the current lump sum payment would be if he was to retire now. Mm-hmm. Follow that logic so far?
So far.
Okay. Do keep in mind, folks, when you take a lump sum payment, Chris and I say repeatedly, pension payments are based on your salary, and they are. But lump sum payments, Chris, are based on what?
The present value of those anticipated future payments, otherwise known as interest rates, are going to affect that, current interest rates. That's how the pension fund is going to decide how much the equivalent lump sum to hand you today would be, instead of you taking the promised monthly or yearly pension that you were entitled to instead. So that's how they make that conversion. There's a time value of money calculation going on there.
Exactly. So the lower interest rates are, the higher the lump sum, because ostensibly the more money you're going to need to replicate the same pension payment. Mm-hmm. And the higher interest rates are, when you take your lump sum, the lower your lump sum payment will be because you will need less to replicate the same pension payment. So the lump sum is interest rate sensitive. Your pension payment itself is interest rate sensitive to the managers of the pension plan. They freak out when interest rates get low because it screws with their return expectations. But it doesn't affect you. I was a police officer. I said that. If I worked 32 years, I would get 80% of my last three, it was either 3 or 5 years salary. I had nothing to do. It didn't say, assuming interest rates were above this amount. If they're below this amount, you only get 75% of your salary. It didn't work that way. It was 80% of my last 3 or 5 years salary, and it had nothing to do with interest rates. But a lump sum payment does have to do with interest rates. Okay, so I just wanted to clarify the air there in case people were wondering, well, why are interest rates messing with this guy's lump sum when Jim and Chris have said on previous podcasts, with a pension, your payments aren't based on interest rates. Your monthly or yearly pension payment doesn't get based on interest rates. It gets based on salary. Lump sum is based on salary and the net present value of those interest rates. Yep. Okay, so we said to protect from these potential losses, I'm wondering if there is something I should be doing with my 401k funds right now, or even my IRA, in an effort to hedge against future interest rates increasing and eroding my large lump sum payment amount. I'm thinking along the lines of using leveraged Treasury ETFs, inverse ETFs, or options. Any ideas? Thanks again. Well, first, and especially to the compliance person listening to this, I am not going to talk about leveraged inverse ETFs and options. So relax. Short of warning this person, don't play with matches. And those products are not intended. Inverse ETFs and leveraged ETFs. Leveraged, they take a lot of leverage, so you can, a little bit of money can bet big in one direction or another. Inverse means it does the inverse, Chris, of what happens. So normally speaking, if interest rates go up, the price of bonds goes down. If interest rates go down, the price of bonds go up. If you inverse that, it throws that on its face, so to speak. And you can profit with rising interest rates instead of dropping interest rates. And a lot of leveraged ETF products are not designed, listener, to be held long term. You said you want to retire in 3 years. These leveraged and inverse products are very dangerous. I do not and will never use them in my practice. They just open me up to too much risk. It is not worth it. And most people don't understand that they are not designed to be held for long periods of time. Right. And by that, I mean more than 24 hours.
Right.
You're supposed to own them for a day. I mean, they are not meant to be owned a long time.
The math doesn't work out long term on those the
it
way
they're
built. So
it doesn't.
So topic for a whole different show.
Exactly, which we won't get into because I'm not going to get into
it. I know.
Now, you mentioned options. That is something that's complex, but not, I don't want to say as complex. It's probably more complex than the leverage products. They're using options within those products, but it's a little more mainstream, and I put that in quotation marks. I don't do options in my practice. If clients have a large holding in a particular equity, we may outsource any type of option strategy on that holding, Chris. There are professionals who specialize in this and can put protections in place using option strategies to help insulate the risk of owning one narrow-focused equity. You might own a ton of money in Apple and you want to hedge that. There are professional asset managers who will specialize in putting option strategies together. To me, if you're going to mess around with options, it should be a full-time job. You should know options markets inside and out. The problem you're going to have, listener, is your 401k isn't going to have option strategies for you to utilize. Now, you might be able to utilize some option strategies to hedge against rising interest rates in your IRA, but I would encourage you to use a well-trained individual who's well-schooled in options to be able to put that together for you, because options, easy come, easy go. And you can lose your skin in that if you don't know what you're doing. You can lose your skin in inverse and leveraged ETFs as well. So my recommendation to him, Chris, is tread slowly, tread carefully. I don't know also how you would have to really know, or the options trader or the person who's helping you hedge this needs to know for each quarter point, half point, full point,
what the sensitivity
right,
is on
right,
that
the
pension.
Sensitivity of the pension is, so they know how much protection to buy. I don't know if you have that or would be able to get that from the pension fund manager. In other words, you got to be able to articulate the potential loss for every 100 basis point, 1% increase in interest rates. So then the options manager or person who's trying to put this hedge in place knows, Chris, how much they need to make if interest rates rise each way to offset it. And you just can't fly into this blindly without knowing all of this. And I think he's biting off a little bit more than he can chew here. That's my take. But again, there are investment advisors out there, you're going to pay dearly for them, who can help with this, I'm sure. But you really need to make sure the investment manager you hire is well-trained on this. And then they're going to say to you, what is the risk I'm trying to insure? How much do you need to make for each quarter, half, three-quarter, 1% point increase in interest rates? What do I need to earn? And you're going to have to get that sensitivity from the pension fund. What do you think, Chris?
Well, I would have... Given this, I would have backed up a few questions. First, why are you looking at only taking the lump sum? We're just kind of assuming he's determined that's it. And also point out that there's almost like a built-in hedge to this situation. If the lump sum becomes less attractive because of this, that just makes the payment of the monthly pension payment more attractive. So there is a bit of a quasi-hedge kind of built into the pension itself. If you think of it that way, if you say, well, now the lump sum isn't very attractive, well, relative to the payments, which haven't changed, that means the payments have gotten better relative to the lump sum amount. So I guess I would be curious at least to know why he's dismissing taking the pension itself and focusing just on the lump sum. And another way to mitigate some of this would be to looking at a partial pension, partial lump sum, if they allow that. A lot of employers will do that, where you don't have to do all pension payments or all lump sum. You could do a blend. And some will do many different proportions. Some only offer 50-50. Some don't offer the choice at all. It's an all or nothing kind of thing. But it'd be worth investigating and discovering that before you start doing these really complicated things that I think you're going to have a tough time pulling off, even with professional help, honestly. This is not a typical approach to doing this. This isn't something a run of the mill that you're going to find a bunch of people experienced at doing this easily and inexpensively. So I'm not sure this is a great approach to your situation, but we don't know the whole picture to kind of understand your thoughts and you know where you're trying to go with this.
Excuse me, exactly. And hopefully he's listened to us long enough to know we favor the pension. Don't look at this just through the eyes of someone who's probably in his late 50s, early 60s. Look at your retirement through the eyes of someone who someday will be in their 80s and 90s. And that 80 and 90-year-old you is going to really appreciate, especially a large telecom company. I can only hazard a couple of guesses of which company this may be, company that will most likely be around for a very long time, company whose pension may be very well positioned. You're going to value the safety and security of pension payments rather than trying to replicate income later in retirement when your ability to understand financial concepts, your interest in it, all of that will begin to wane as you get into your 70s, 80s, and 90s, especially your 80s and 90s. So do keep that in mind. Chris and I talk about that all the time, and that's an excellent point, Chris. He did just jump into the lump sum. He didn't explain to us why. He didn't say, oh, I've crunched the numbers. We have more than enough secure income, and I want to take a pension payment. I hope he's not just getting in love with a high six-figure lump sum, thinking, ooh, I'm rich. I'm going to take this. It's a lot of work. Why do you think pensions offer lump sums? They want to get out of the retirement business. It's tough. And if you have all your money and you're not pooling the risk, which is what a pension will do, you got to get it right, and you got to get it right forever until you die. And Chris and I just believe passionately in lifetime guaranteed income to cover what we call your minimum dignity floor of food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare. And we preach constantly. And we've had listeners. We've had you iTunian do-it-yourselfers, Vanguardians get a hold of us and say, hey, I disagree with that. I'm always going to have the mental capacity. Not everybody's going to lose that. I really enjoy managing my own money. That's fine. There was a time I enjoyed eating pizza, drinking beer, and going out partying all the time. And I don't do that anymore. We change as we get older. And there's going to come a time where your ability to understand financial concepts will either wane naturally, or you might just lose interest in it. But Chris and I do fully concede there are some people who never will wane and never will lose interest.
And there are some pensions not worthy of considering the pension payment. So we're certainly not saying absolutely take a pension payment, but don't be automatically dismissive of it. Just because everyone else maybe is doing it, or you heard somebody say one time the lump sum is a better way to go. It might be, but don't just automatically dismiss the pension payment. Maybe there's a good reason he seems to have done that, but
just consider your pension a bottomless cup of coffee, as opposed to entering retirement with a finite amount of coffee. If you knew you might not have enough coffee to last you all through your retirement, you might think twice on taking that second or third cup, or throwing a cup away. Who cares? It's got cold. Let me throw it away and refill it. No. You got to nuke it. We don't know how long this is going to last. A pension, Social Security, and an income annuity is a bottomless cup of coffee. It never ends. You can have it forever. It's nothing wrong with having a bottomless cup of coffee to take care of your food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare. This the way we look at it. Yep. Okay, anyways, I told you that was a pretty good one. We weren't going to get too deep into that. So we're going to pause, folks.
Well, if you have time, let's just do another one and finish it out.
Well, it's already 5:10.
I know. I got permission.
Yeah, well, you do. I still have to go home. All right, let me look through this.
You don't have anyone to report to.
Hey, I got plants waiting for me at home. I have a garden waiting to be harvested. All right. I have no idea what I'm reading, so this is going to be new for you and I. I literally just pulled this out of the pack. I have no idea. Oh, well, we may end up reading this and say no.
We might delete this one.
We may.
There's four live listeners right now. They might be the only ones ever to hear this question.
I took it because it's short, and it came in February. That's not why I took it. It just was one of the shorter ones I saw. Okay, it says, love your show. Learning a lot each week. I have a question related to your five-part series on your planning method. Oh, okay. Well, that I know.
Yeah.
Okay. When you determine your final fun number, F-U-N, fun number, do you revisit it periodically to see if it can go up or down? Oh, wait a minute. We answered this, didn't it? Based on market returns. Seem like this number should be fluid and based on what your investments do. Didn't we answer
this? I think we should
answer
it again if we haven't. We've talked about this. I don't know if there's been a clean answer, but I mean, the short answer is yes, you would revisit this. This is why you kind of update and monitor. Some of this will be buffered. You might think, well, yeah, it can be totally volatile and it'll go up and down and I'll spend more in good years and less in bad years. You want to protect yourself a bit from that in our approach, because Remember, you're only 60 once, you're only 61 once, you're only 62 once. The point is, if you cut back because you have a lean year, you may give up permanently the ability to do something you were planning on. So we like to see people protect a number of years of fun spending out of their fun bucket, out of their fun number, by having it safe, and that's not going to be volatile. And the point is, really to protect you from having to cut back, but leave you the potential, say fun money that you're not going to use for a while, have that exposed in a way that it could gain. And maybe if you get lucky and it goes really well, you can suddenly increase your fun budget, but you've bought yourself some time or some protection or buffer by having some, you know, 4 or 5 years maybe in cash or cash-like items. And then you are, hopefully could let a rebound occur. If there's a cutback, you wouldn't immediately have to go lean on your fund spending. That's our approach. You could certainly just ride the waves up and down with your fund money, because it truly is just fund money. And if you're okay with that, but, we always remind people who are going to take that approach that, when you're in the trough of the wave and you cut back, you might not be around to visit the top of the next wave. So don't dismiss that. Do not undervalue the ability to do things and create experiences and memories sooner than later, because you never know when you're going to have to be slowing down due to factors out of your control.
Okay. I have a feeling we answered that in the past, but I cannot remember.
My guess is you used most of the words, though, so now I've answered it.
Oh, okay.
So people have two ways of listening to it, maybe.
Well, what I want to do then is make up with a different question that kind of relates to the question we just answered before.
Okay.
Kind of kill two birds with one stone.
Sure.
This came in May, and it did not print out very clearly. So it's, I don't know what was wrong with that printer that day, but you know how it prints one word and then the same word, but just off like a 1/16th of an inch.
That was when that printer was dying, and now we have a nice new printer. But
we do.
That was at the end of the.
So the point is, it may take me a second. It's a very short email, but it's making me dizzy trying to read it. Okay, so I believe it says the following: Jim is the best.
No, it doesn't. I can clearly tell you. I can with confidence say it does not say that.
Well, it should. It begins, I am a civil service employee at the U.S. Postal Service.
Mm-hmm.
I am considering retirement at the end of this year. Would it make more sense for me to buy life insurance as opposed to taking the pension and leaving half my pension to my husband if I pass away? This option will cost $350 per month. And what they mean by cost, listener, is they will get, while she is alive, $350 a month less than if she takes the single life pension, the joint and survivor pension with a 50% payout to the husband. So if they turn on that option, she'll get $350 a month less while they're both alive. But if she dies first, the husband will get half the pension.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if she takes the single life, she'll get $350 a month more. So it's some serious money, $350 a month. $350 a month more. But if she dies first, hubby's SOL, doesn't get anything.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay. So
she's thinking of considering the protection for the husband in the form of life insurance instead of taking the survivorship option.
Mm-hmm. So she writes, I'm sure life insurance wouldn't cost as much as that. Let me pause there, listener. You are 61. You don't tell me how old your husband is, but you have to get the life insurance policy. It's not a joint second to die policy where you can leverage two lives. And you're 61. Chris is not that far from that. He's no spring chicken. So I'm not saying it's going to be cheaper. A lot's going to depend. You seemed with certainty that it would not cost you more than $350 a month to buy enough life insurance to replicate a 50%, enough money where your husband could then buy an income annuity if he wanted that would replicate 50% of the pension, your pension. Mm-hmm. So she's thinking of taking the single life, Chris.
And buying insurance.
Buying insurance. And she doesn't think she would even have to spend the $350 a month. Mm-hmm. I'm not convinced on that. But the strategy, folks, this is a typical strategy that a lot of investment advisors and insurance agents do espouse. For better or worse, I'm not going to pass judgment. But it is a strategy where they encourage you to take the single life pension, not the 100% joint and survivor or the 50% joint and survivor in this case, and under the guise that you would be able to buy more life insurance with the $350 a month extra, that if you died early, the husband will receive the large life insurance payout, or in the way you described, listener, you feel it won't even cost $350 a month. So you could buy enough life insurance to protect your husband for the lost pension and still have a little bit of money left over. So they're trying to have their cake and eat it too.
Yeah, and I'd point out a few things. One, the pension amount isn't going to be affected by current interest rates. So one thing to always consider, somebody could sit there across the desk from you and crunch all the numbers about how much income you could generate by taking the life insurance policy and purchasing income in an annuity of some kind. And if you just happen to pass away in a low interest rate environment, that makes it very challenging to generate income. Because as we've talked about many times in the past, annuity income is directly affected. The cost to generate annuity income is directly affected by current interest rates. You're completely insulated by that by choosing the 50% payout. The other thing, there's a few things actually going on here. I'm guessing that she's in FERS. Based on the fact that she's talking about a 50% payout and that there's about the $350 a month. Being at the Postal Service, all those kind of things are leading me in my mind to believe she's in FERS, which is going to have a cost of living adjustment, which people look at it and they look at just the difference now. That amount of income can be vastly higher down the road as there are cost of living adjustments, where life insurance, the death benefit is usually in a straightforward life insurance policy, a fixed amount. So it's not going to naturally adjust for inflation. You could get some more exotic things in the insurance world that might compensate for that. But again, you're taking something so simple, which is if I pass away first, my husband gets half of this. It just happens. It's so simple. And trying to save a couple of dollars on something that adds extra risk and complexity and might end up blowing up in the face of your husband who you have now left behind alone. Why do that? And I would admit, yes, you need to crunch some numbers and at least consider it. Don't just automatically do it, but don't ignore all the issues that are related to this decision. And don't underestimate the simple, straightforward nature of leaving behind a pension for the survivor, for your husband in this particular case, that's inflation adjusted, that will just kick in automatically if you pass away. And if you're in FEHB, having him as a survivor on here will entitle him likely to FEHB health insurance, where if you take the single life, he doesn't get that unless he qualifies on his own behalf. You didn't share with us that, but there's other auxiliary issues that might be at play here.
Right. I especially like that part because the husband needs to receive at least 10% of the FERS pension to stay in the Fed health insurance plan. And it's a very, very good plan combined with Medicare. It's bulletproof. I don't want to say totally bulletproof. They can always change it later. But it's a very, very good health care plan for retirees.
Yeah, and if they're not an annuitant, which means they're not receiving pension payments after you pass away, not only have you pulled the rug out from under them for pension payments, you've pulled out the rug from him for medical coverage. Do you not like this person?
And then don't forget the final thing. I won't say half, but the smaller of the two Social Security benefits will also disappear at the death of the first spouse, mm-hmm. whether that's you or your husband. So if you died first, granted, hubby will get hopefully a life insurance payout, and I'm not convinced $350 a month would buy enough life insurance to replicate 50% of your pension, which the federal government is willing to guarantee for $350 a month mm-hmm. cost. But you are going to have, or your husband will suffer, a loss of Social Security as well. Mm-hmm. Well, let me keep reading the rest of her email.
So I'm very suspicious of this attraction to life insurance.
I've never been a fan of taking the larger pension and buying life insurance.
When this complicates it, the two things I mentioned, the cost of living adjustment that's part of her pension, so powerful.
Exactly.
And secondly, the strings tied to the FEHB health plan.
Absolutely.
That's huge too.
Absolutely.
Those aren't factors that normally are going to have to be considered if you just have a private company pension. Here you have to consider those.
Right.
And they're very important.
If you've counseled with another advisor or more likely an insurance agent who might be espousing this strategy, make sure when they're trying to tell you how much insurance you need, they are factoring in the fact that mm-hmm. you are not going to, or your husband, if he tries to replicate your pension, they really need to be replicating an annuity with a cost of living mm-hmm. adjustment tied yep. to CPI. There's only mm-hmm. one company right now in the whole United States that offers a annuity tied to CPI, and I think they recently stopped doing that, Chris. If memory mm-hmm. serves me correct, that might have closed down recently.
And need a bunch of extra money to help pay health insurance, too.
But exactly, and he's going to need more money for health insurance. The reason only one company, and I think that company stopped offering it, offers an annuity tied to CPI, it's incredibly expensive to insure.
Yeah.
And the federal government's giving that.
Yeah.
So I don't know if the insurance agent who's crunching these numbers took that into an account and instead just showed you, oh, you're only going to need X amount of hundreds of thousands, and look, that will buy a annuity stream that will pay your husband 50% of what you were receiving. But are they accounting for COLA, and are they accounting for the extra health insurance cost he's going to have? Not so much on Medicare, because you will be covering the Medicare premiums anyways if you enroll in both under the
Fed
plan.
Yeah, but the FEHB is better than Part D
Medigap.
And Medigap.
Right,
yep.
exactly. Mm-hmm. Your husband's going to really save on the Part D and the Medigap.
Yep.
Okay, so let me continue with this email. Okay, so again, she says, I'm sure life insurance would not be as much as that. And Chris and I went down that little rabbit hole and explained we disagree. So she said, I am 61. I have no health problems, at least that I'm aware of, and no debt. Do we actually need either life insurance or the pension? Well, let me pause there. We already said we're not sure you need the life insurance strategy. The pension? My gut tells me yes, just because you have no health problems that you're aware of and you're healthy, you could have longevity. You could live a very long time and you would love the pension payout. So I'm leaning towards, yeah, you could use the pension. I don't want to say definitively. We don't know enough about your situation. But I would say, yeah, she does need the pension. What are you thinking, Chris?
Well, I don't think she was asking giving up the pension. It may just take the single life and not buy insurance is what she's saying. So basically, rob the husband of all pension income.
No, if you're thinking of robbing your husband, and I speak not as a man, but as a financial planner, if you're thinking of robbing the husband, so to speak, I'm against it for all the reasons Chris has already outlined. If you're asking rhetorically, do we need either? Should I take the lump sum payout? I would be hesitant and against.
Well, no, this
that.
Isn't a lump sum choice. The USPS isn't going to give
True.
Her a lump sum.
Okay,
but it is possible if they've amassed so many other assets that there's no way they could spend all their money in any foreseeable lifetime, combined lifetime. then I'll admit there's a possibility that they could just forego any type of survivorship benefit and pay out of pocket for all, you know, all the exposure that will occur when that pension goes away and when the lowest of the Social Security goes away. They might have enough assets where it's not a question. I doubt it. If she's asking these kinds of questions, that doesn't mean that they are, that usually doesn't mean that they are so wealthy they couldn't possibly spend all their money. That's, these aren't the kinds of questions those people ask. So I would say analyze it, figure out how much secure income that you likely would need, and you'll find at the first passing, because of the loss of one of the Social Security benefits and complete loss of the pension, you'll probably find that your husband would be in a precarious situation if you are in fact trying to cover your minimum dignity floor with your secure income. I've not seen a normal case where you drop both of those off and the survivor is good to go. It's hard to imagine that just one Social Security benefit and no other secure income would be rock solid enough to meet the minimum dignity floor of the survivor. But maybe they live in a very, very low cost area, have very basic living expenses. I'll admit it's possible, but I don't like it. I get the feeling that, they were getting like partial bits of information or advice from people, and the whole story hasn't really been considered. I think someone either do it yourself or have someone look at the whole picture, and they'll be able to point you in the right direction given the whole story.
To the story, so let me just read her last sentence. So after she said, do we need either really, she wrote, we have kids that are irresponsible and will probably not be able to take care of themselves in their old age. So we're unsure what to do. So that added a little twist. And I don't want to go too deep down in this because I could turn this into a whole EDU show. But if you truly do have irresponsible children, you don't say how they're irresponsible. Are they spendthrifts? Are they drug addicts? Do they have special needs? What is the problem with your children that you don't think that they would be responsible with money or take care of themselves in their old age, as you say? Again, is it physical? Is it mental? Is it emotional? Is it just the behavioral? We don't know, but these are things that you are going to have to take into an account. And if they are not going to be able to take care of themselves, it did throw a little loop into this when she said, Chris, do we need either really? Because if you are correct, or one of your assumptions that you gave is correct, and she doesn't need the pension because she's amassed wealth elsewhere, especially if that wealth is in what we call always taxable accounts, your TSP, which for those who don't know stands for Thrift Savings Plan. It's kind of the 401k, if you will, for federal government employees. It's not a 401k, but it's just an easy way for you guys to understand it. But if she has a massive TSP, Chris, or IRA, or if the has a 401k somewhere else at a different employer or whatever, but just a lot of money in an always taxable retirement account, when I read that she has children who are going to be irresponsible, will not be able to take care of themselves financially, and maybe, because I don't quite know if she was referencing just financially or physically, may not be able to take care of themselves, they need a trust for protection and control. And as we have said repeatedly, always taxable retirement accounts mix when named as beneficiaries of trusts, like oil and water. They don't go together. So if you now need to throw in children into this mix, life insurance or Roth accounts, or at least under current laws, brokerage-styled or non-retirement assets are all wonderful assets to leave to trusts to protect them and control them so your children don't overspend or mismanage or be robbed or whatever the case may be. You know, again, don't really expand on the issue with your children. So I'm thinking in my mind, if they don't need some or all of the pension, take the joint pension, whether it's 100% or 50%, we'd have to crunch the numbers, and use some or all of the pension payment to buy a guaranteed second-to-die guaranteed universal life policy on both yours and your husband's life, get the leverage of two lives, leave what could be multiple millions of dollars, 100% tax-free, to a trust that could easily receive it. Life insurance mixes like coffee syrup and milk. I know you never grew up with coffee syrup, did you? Yeah, I knew you were going to say that. That's an East Coast thing, coffee syrup. You put coffee syrup and milk. Like cream and coffee, spreads right through. You never heard of coffee syrup?
No.
I don't think so. It's kind of an East Coast thing. But what I was trying to let her know, naming life insurance as beneficiary of a trust for protection and control mixes very well. Help me out here. It's like what mixes well? What goes well together?
Peanut butter and chocolate.
Yeah, they don't mix. Peanut butter cups.
They're not mixed. They're separate in there.
No, but they go well together. They complement each other. That's what I mean.
Okay.
However,
peanut butter and jelly, Reese's peanut butter cups.
A TSP.
Whipped cream on ice cream.
A TSP, when named when a trust is named as beneficiary of a TSP or an IRA or a 401k, they go together like
bad news.
Oil and water. They just
and
don't
that's being
mix.
Kind.
Like vinegar and baking soda.
Oh, there you go.
Just
that's
it's a
better.
Mess. Mm-hmm. It is a mess. It goes everywhere. Crap goes everywhere if you do that. So when she added that sentence, it made me realize this could go a lot further. There's not enough here. What I think you need, listener, because we're going to wrap up, but what you need to do, you need to find a planner who can help you with all this. Don't listen to two yahoos on a podcast and think, oh, I got complete and total financial planning. No, we read a very brief, very short on fact email, tried to guess some of the things and give you things to think of. Mm-hmm. You need someone, not someone who's going to try to sell you life insurance or try to get your TSP money and manage it for you, but someone who's just going to give you impartial advice. You need to get advice first. I often say to people, how can I or any competent advisor tell you what to do with your money until they first know what your money has to do for you? And whether that's how to invest the money, whether or not to take a single life pension, joint pension, 50% joint pension, whether or not to buy life insurance or not, any of that. How can anyone tell you what to do with your money until they know what your money has to do for you? So I would strongly, strongly recommend you do some planning first and get some competent help and then start making these decisions, because some of your decisions are going to be irrevocable and you intend to, well, you said you're going to turn 61 in July, but you might retire at the end of this year. So you still have time, but you really need to do some planning and some forethought, especially with your children. And what is your aim with them, and how are you going to protect and control their inheritance? Because as you put it, your children are irresponsible and will probably not be able to take care of themselves in their old age. So that needs to be addressed if it's important to you.
Yep, for sure.
Okay.
Well, on that note, we have completed another Q&A show. Those of you who are interested in sending in your own questions, just reach out on our website. That's jimhelps.com. That's jimhelps.com. On there, you will find a contact form that you can fill out, send in your own questions. You can also learn a little bit more about us on that website, about what we do, our philosophy. If you've listened to the podcast for a while, I'm sure you've picked up on our philosophy and our approach to retirement planning. Bit unique, not bizarre, but unique in the way we approach a few things. We think it has a lot of common sense behind it and makes sense to a lot of people. If you want to learn more, feel free to reach out on that website, jimhelps.com. And let's see. I think that's about it. Jimmy, have anything else you want to say?
No, I think that is about it. These were five or six. Mm-hmm. I forget how many we answered.
Nailed six today.
Six. These were six, I think, varied questions. So mm-hmm. hopefully people found this interesting. And if anybody has additional questions for us, remember, unlike Chris, be pithy in your questions. The long 3-4 page email questions, we just can't get to them. They're too long. We try to. We'll try to turn some of those into EDU shows, but we can't promise that. But if you have questions, be pithy, but not too pithy, where we have to do a lot of guessing. Try to give us enough facts to help answer your question. And you can send them, you can go to our website, jimhelps.com. That's J-I-M-H-E-L-P-S.com. I think there's a contact us button somewhere on there. And if you do it through the website, I believe both Chris and I get a copy, right? And I think they do. I
usually
can't remember.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of gives Chris a chance to see what's coming. But he receives so many emails and he's so busy with planning, I don't think he really even...
I usually glance at
him.
I usually glance.
And it doesn't get you answered any quicker, that I can say. But the other thing you can do is email us directly. Just email Jim at JimHelps. That's Jim at JIMHELPS.com. Email your question. Indicate in the subject line that it is a question for the podcast. And we'll print it. Well, I print it. And it goes on a stack, literally in the attic now. On the little table that I'm on, and I will pick from that stack of emails. I will say, listeners, we get far too many emails for us to answer them all on one show, and until someone who's very, very stubborn agrees to do a second Q&A show, we won't be able to get through this stack of emails very quickly. But one person on this show, I won't name who, knows how to use the recording equipment. The other one is just so smart, he doesn't want to embarrass the other person by taking over and using the recording equipment. So
he's alone, doing the show alone.
He pretends he doesn't know how to use the recording equipment.
Uh-huh.
But his technological expertise is second to none, and he probably could do it if need be.
Probably.
But anyways, all jokes aside, we're way too busy to start doing a second show. But in the future, we very well may, and that can help us get through the stack of questions. But right now, we try to get questions answered on a regular basis and turn some into EDU shows and address everyone's needs. Anyways, anything else you want to add?
I think that's it. Thanks, everybody, for listening, and we'll be back next week with another show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Saulnier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
Investors should consider the investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses of investment company products carefully before investing. The prospectus contains this and other information about the investment company. Prospectuses may be obtained from your advisor and should be read in full. All guarantees are backed by the claims-paying ability of the issuing insurer. Withdrawals and death benefits are subject to income tax. If withdrawals and other distributions are received prior to age 59 and a half, a 10% penalty may apply. Shares, when redeemed, may be worth more or less than the original cost.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA, SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.